from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, older adults demonstrated better multitasking skills and other cognitive functions after playing a custom-designed video game. That's according to a recent UCSF study. After months of playing a driving game called Neuro Racer, seniors were better at remembering information and paying attention. UCSF neuroscientist Adam Ghazali, one of the study's co-authors, will join us to talk about the potential use of video games as therapeutic tools, both to improve cognitive skills and possibly even to treat mental disorders. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. A number of local science researchers from the University of California, San Francisco have revealed in the September 5th issue of Nature that they have found, as a result of a four-year, $300,000 study, a method to reverse negative aging effects of the brain by use of a video game custom designed to improve cognitive control. A number of 60 to 85-year-olds played the three-dimensional game, Neuro Racer, for an hour three times a week over the course of a month, and as a result, considerably improved their memories and attention abilities, as well as their ability to multitask. We're joined in studio this hour by one of the main authors of the study, who also directs the Neuroscience Imaging Center at UCSF, Adam Ghazali, MD, PhD, here with us for our second Forum Hour. And welcome.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you here. Well, let's talk about what this is. We're joking about this being a long and winding road, but that was essentially what the Neuro Racer represented to people. But you had things, just want to have listeners understand what you had them doing, a video game really, where things were popping up all the time and they had to essentially move their attention from one thing to another.
Yeah, so I think it's helpful just to give a little context of why we designed the game, and then I'll tell you about it in detail. We've been showing in our lab, and others as well have supported the fact that as we get older, our ability to deal with interference in terms of distraction and multitasking decline. And this is reflective of a more general problem in what we call cognitive control, which is how you interact with the environment in a goal-directed way. And so we've been showing in the brain what happens as we get older and how sensitive we are to this interference. And other types of abilities like working memory and sustained attention also decline. After telling that sort of bad news for the last decade, around 5 years ago, I got inspired to see if we could do anything about it to help older adults improve these abilities, because when they would come down to the lab, that's what we would hear. They would
to help stave off the interferences.
Exactly, to help deal better with how they directed their attention and interacted in this super complex environment that we live in. And so I thought that maybe we could just use the tools that we designed in our lab to study these abilities and just have them practice them and see what would happen. But I quickly realized that they would never do that because it's so incredibly boring. If they're not like paid to do it for that 1 hour, they would never even finish it. So I became inspired based on a literature that had been growing that shows that commercial video games like first-person shooters, even when played by younger adults, improve some of these same abilities in distraction resistance, in attention, and other types of cognitive control. So I was like, well, how about if we design our own game from scratch that has many of the qualities of an action video game, but design it with a very targeted focus to improve these abilities in older adults? And that's when I sought out some friends of mine that worked in the video game industry as professionals, brought them down to the lab and said, here's my students, my postdocs. I came up with an idea of a design for this game, this Neuro Racer, and then we worked together over a year developing it before we even ran a study on it.
And if they maintain these skills about 6 months after their training, which is also pretty dramatic. And what we're talking about really is the plasticity of the brain, aren't we?
Yeah, so we can drive plasticity of the brain. Plasticity is essentially the ability of our brain to modify itself, both structurally, chemically, even functionally, in response to a stimulus in the environment. for a long time, we thought that that property of our brain essentially ended when we finished a critical stage of development. And then we were just destined to lose brain power for the rest of our lives. Now we appreciate that plasticity is retained throughout the lifespan. Even if it declines, it's still there. And so we felt that we could capitalize on that retained plasticity and harness it through video game mechanics and then see what happens in the brain, what other skills change, and how do some of these abilities sustain themselves.
This could be, you forgive the choice of language here, kind of a game changer. I mean, particularly with things where I know brain fitness is a kind of a controversial field, but the potential for, one thinks of ADHD and dementia and depression and all kinds of things when you're talking about really making the brain more plastic.
Yeah, I think that the field is controversial, but not because the foundational concept that the brain is plastic and can change. I don't think that part is controversial. I mean, as far as I know, every neuroscientist I've ever met believes in the plasticity of the brain. The question is, and I guess the controversy that ensues around it, is what is the most appropriate way of tapping that plasticity? And so the idea is that not everything is going to be equally effective at doing that, just like not every form of physical fitness would be equally effective in improving your physical well-being. So I think that we have a lot of work to do in figuring out what the details are, with the ingredients of the recipe to maximally harness this plasticity.
Talking to Adam Ghazali, who is director of the Neuroscience Imaging Center at UCSF and co-founder of the company Achille Interactive Labs, which is developing the next generation of the NeuroRacer game, and we'll talk about that connection to Achille. But NeuroRacer, I mean, it actually pushes people to go farther. You get better, and instead of it getting easier, it gets harder, right? So it's more of a challenge. Of course, you said they're not getting paid, but at the same time, they know they're doing this for a purpose. They have an end game involved.
Yeah.
They're going to get better cognitive skills.
For sure. They're down here to they come down to the lab to participate in it as a research study, and they know that the goal is to see what changes in their brain. How the game works is that we really challenge the players, the participants in the study, on two different tasks. One task, they're driving along this winding road, and it actually demands a lot of attention. They use a joystick. The road is turning to the left, to the right, going hills up and down. So as they go up a hill, they have to push on the joystick forward to give it a little more gas. They have to pull back when they're going down a hill, turn left, turn right, and the road is always moving. So we wanted to really pull their attention on tracking this car in a 3D environment. While that's happening, signs are popping up, and they have to press the button on the joystick as rapidly as they can to only the target signs, so green circles, let's say, but not green pentagons. It's actually very hard not to press it for a green pentagon, especially as you get older. And so these two tasks are being engaged in at the same time. And what you mentioned is what we think is part of the special sauce of this approach, which is adaptivity. And by that, we mean that as they get better, as the performance improves, the game detects that and uses a built-in algorithm so that it gets equivalently more challenging. And if they get a little worse at a time, then the game gets a little easier. So it keeps them right in their sweet spot. We think that this maximally targets plasticity in the brain by pushing it right at that level of your ability. The other good part about it is that it doesn't become overly frustrating by being too hard, nor does it become overly boring by being too easy. So it actually creates sort of this, what video game developers would call a flow state, where they can just engage right at that sort of comfortable but challenging level through the whole act of playing the game.
And if you'd like to see a sample of what the video game looks like, you can check it out on our website, kqed.org/forum. We have it posted there. And they did EEG recordings, actually, to suggest there were changes in neural network and changes in brainwave activity. I mean, all of this stuff with cognitive control notwithstanding, we're actually talking about brain change. And there's always been this assumption for a long time that the brain just continues to atrophy and get worse as we get older, except maybe for wisdom, one hopes. But, you know, that's always been the understanding. Now you've got a study that says getting back to kind of a 20-year-old activity as far as the brain is concerned.
Yeah, that was a key part of the study and was actually a really challenging aspect of the game design, in that we built a version of the game that could be played while we recorded activity from what was going on in the brain. We actually could do this with both EEG and fMRI, which we're doing in studies now. But in this paper, we used EEG before and after a gameplay to see what exactly changed. And what we found was that a measure of activity from the front part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, the brain, the part of our brain that has evolved the most and is involved in cognitive control, that activity level is deficient in older adults before they play compared to younger adults. But after they play, then it rises to a level that it's no longer different than a 20-year-old. So it's really exciting. This is a measure that we obtain that is what we call time-locked to when those signs appear. So right when those signs appear, we start recording, and we could see that within a third of a second after that sign comes up, you get this burst of a frequency that we call theta, which is a low frequency from the front part of the brain, and that the magnitude of the amplitude of that improves after you play.
So midline frontal part?
Midline frontal theta, right? So that's where it generates from.
And this could be, you know, the neurological Ponce de Leon, you know, secret to going back to youth and all that sort of thing. But we don't want to get too carried away with inflating or hyping it. I mean, it's a big leap in some ways to the real world, as I think you said. And there's a lot more science that needs to be done. You want to overinterpret these results.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's probably one reason why I engage in these type of interviews, because I do want there to be a note of balance to this story. I think it's very exciting.
It's a big deal, though.
Yeah, it's exciting to see this much plasticity. One thing that we should come back to is that not just the abilities on the game improved, but other skills in cognitive control also improve, which is one of the most unique aspects of the study. But in terms of being balanced, I like to emphasize that this does not imply that all video games are effective and that they're the panacea of all that ails us. What we did here was build a very targeted game to known neural deficits within a specific population. And, you know, we had done a lot of that basic work to understand what was changing in the first place. So It's exciting. It shows that video games and the dynamics involved in them can be used to have very powerful impacts on the brain, especially when targeted. And if this is a game changer at all, I hope what that means is not that this is some discovery of the answer, but rather a step in how we can go about carefully developing and then validating our tools to change the brain in an impactful way.
Well, the title of Nature says game changer. I mean, yeah. Clever title. But
yeah, I noticed that.
Talking to Adam Ghazali, who, again, is co-founder of Achille. And there, we were talking about you're doing advice to Achille before it went on the air, which is a interactive labs, talking about possibly even turning this into a commodity. I mean, it raises some tough questions because you're a researcher, you're a scientific researcher, you're working for the University of California, but this has gotten a lot of attention. And as a result of that, there are a lot of people who would like to buy this video game. You know?
Yeah, it is complicated. We've received thousands of emails over the last week from people that in some cases demand the game, which has been interesting.
Deliver it, you pay the postage.
Exactly. They're like, we will buy this game, just tell us where. And the reality is that we didn't develop the game as a product. It's a research experiment. It's not really deliverable. It's not it's not packaged in a way that could really happen, at least not right now. It was developed as a research tool very carefully to test what we did, and we're using it in many other studies. But we never thought of it as a product. And I mean, and it's complicated. A lot of the requests we get are for people that have all sorts of different conditions related to their brain. And although it might have an impact, we don't know that it does. And even the study was designed to answer a specific question about what changes in the brain and what other abilities change. But we didn't have the number of participants we would need to allow us to talk about real-world impact. So there's a lot more research that needs to be done to understand it. And that's where we're heading.
You're going to have to do some more functional magnetic resonance imaging and things of that sort.
Oh, yeah, we're doing that. We're looking at all ways of augmenting these, the potential of improving abilities with this game. We have new games being developed in the in the lab that target different neural processes. We are looking at how this impacts other population, like children and those with ADHD. So there's a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done before we have something here that we would be confident in putting out as a product.
There's a good underlying principle here. My dad, who was not short of wisdom, used to say, of course, he fell into dementia, but before he did, he would do those jumble word games, you know, in the mm-hmm. you see where the crossword puzzles. He's keeping myself from Alzheimer's with this, you know, as if there's a kind of preventive way of extending the brain through games and through the sort of thing that involves plasticity.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of reasons to believe there's this entire sort of concept called cognitive reserve that suggests if we strengthen our brain, even if you develop the pathology associated with something as horrendous as Alzheimer's disease, the time that you'll reveal the functional deficits that really define dementia will be later in life. And so, you know, there is a lot of interest and developing scientific literature that we benefit by having stronger brains on maintaining the health of our cognition later in life.
So this could affect obviously short-term memory, but also states associated with cognitive control, and dementia is one of those, depression, ADHD.
Yeah, so that was a really exciting part of this study. To tell you the truth, we weren't sure if we would find those effects given the smaller numbers of participants in the study. We were really trying to see what happened in the brain, but we did other tests of cognitive control besides those that we were directly training. So we looked at, for example, working memory, which is holding information in mind for short periods of time, and sustained attention, which is a vigilance test, which is holding your attention to something that's very boring to make a response for a very rare target. And these were not directly trained by the game itself. And also we had control groups in the game, and one of the control groups, an active control that played the game in a single task version, we certainly don't think had a different level of working memory or sustained attention. And yet we found that the multitasking training version of the game selectively improved these skills in these older adults after training. These are skills that we know are part of cognitive control and are deficient with aging. So that's this sort of elusive concept that everyone talks about called transfer. And that's sort of like the holy grail, right? How do you train on something and then something else gets better, right? Because everyone feels that if you just were better at this video game, then that wouldn't be of much use to you. And so we have some evidence of transfer here. But what I think is most interesting about it is transfer is not magic. It's not that you move from one type of skill to another through some mystical property, but rather what it implies is that because we did see some transfer to like working memory to sustained attention, what it means is that there must be an underlying neural bridge between them that overlap between what we train and these other skills. So it teaches us about the brain's mechanisms and the processes that might exhibit this type of transfer. And I think we have an example here of that, and we see it in the neural recordings too. Because when we find that the midline prefrontal theta, this activity measure from the front part of the brain, improves in older adults, we also find that the degree that it improves, or those people that show the biggest improvement in the brain activity on the game, also show the most improvement on the untrained sustained attention task. So it's a bridge. It shows that there's a bridge between what changed in the brain in the game and what changed on another skill. So clearly they're connected.
So do you come down, I mean, notwithstanding all the arguments about video games, you know, being too violent and all that sort of thing, putting that aside, I mean, there was also arguments about what does it do for kids or what does it not do for them, hand-eye coordination mm-hmm. on the positive side. But, you know, some parents were concerned about kids getting too mesmerized by the games or getting too taken away from concentrating on the things they should be concentrating on, all that.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally good for kids to play video games, even to excess, which is often the case.
Yeah, that's not something that I would say. I mean, I definitely feel that everything is sort of yin and yang, and there's always positives and negatives to anything that you do. And that's why it's so important that we move forward carefully with any type of intervention or anything that we're going to be spending a lot of time on. So even now, as we talk about these positive benefits, are there side effects? Well, you might dismiss it and say it's a video game. How could there be side effects? But it's something we should think about and understand. And maybe a side effect is that it's so addicting and and so much fun that this is all you do. And that wouldn't necessarily be something that
gives you an endorphin high. Yeah,
exactly. And then, you know, you don't do other things that also would benefit you.
Do we know from this, let me go from kids to older adults, do we know from this that older adults are maybe more trainable?
There has been suggestions that people that have deficits to start have a bigger impact of training, essentially because they have more room to grow. And, you know, very young children obviously learn very rapidly because they're incredibly plastic. We are doing some studies now to look at different learning curves across the lifespan and understand them. I don't necessarily think that this suggests that, but it's something that is very interesting.
You also have mentioned that midline frontal theta a couple times and the bridge and the transfer. This means more access to the brain, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think what it hopefully means is that we're learning how to take neuroscience, the tools of neuroscience that we have used to study the brain, largely in the goal of understanding how the brain works, and then coupling it with tools that we're developing that might improve the brain so that we can really start being much more targeted in our approaches. If we understand the mechanisms and the processes and what's plastic and what's not and what's connected, then we could be more directed when we develop something to improve the brain.
Wasn't there a study, maybe you can tell me about this, I just read briefly about a study of London taxi cab drivers and the way they navigated and changes in brain and cognition?
Yeah, so that study was done several years ago and it was done in the UK. And what they showed was that taxi cab drivers compared to bus drivers had larger hippocampi, which are areas of the brain that are associated with memory consolidation. And this was with an MRI scan. So even at that gross structural level, there was a difference in the size of this brain area. And as we know, UK taxi drivers are notorious for an incredible knowledge base of all of the different routes.
They have to learn all that stuff before they can get even in a cab.
Exactly. Yeah. They go through a really, really rigorous training and testing procedure. Well, bus drivers have a route and they don't have as extensive knowledge. So it was just a really interesting example to show that plasticity could even lead to changes that you could see at the macro level when you compare between two groups.
Let me go back to your study, though. I mean, the study that you are one of the leading scientists on. It's almost as if you can calibrate each decade in terms of decline. And as I said earlier, we were working with 60 to 85-year-olds, and we kind of, back to the future, went back to the 20-year level or the level that we have of 20s.
Yeah, that was one of the features of the study. So there were multiple experiments that we did over the years that we've been doing this project. And on one of them, we used the game as a diagnostic where we had people across the adult lifespan from age 20 to age 80 come into the lab and play the game. And then we calculated something that we call a multitasking cost, which is essentially the cost you pay to multitask. And so how we do that is simply look at your accuracy level when you do that sign task alone versus how you do that sign task when you also drive at the same time. And 20-year-olds, despite believing that they are perfect at multitasking, do show a significant decline, around 27%, in their ability to do the sign task when they're driving at the same time. But what we see is that with each decade of life, this cost increases. Your ability to multitask declines all the way into the 60, almost 70th percentile of drop when you're in your later years of 70 to 80 years old. And so this type of decline across the lifespan has been shown with other abilities that we call fluid cognitive abilities, things like processing speed, working memory, and multitasking and task switching fall into that category.
Our guest is Adam Ghazali, and he is Neuroscience Imaging Center Director at University of California, San Francisco. I'm looking at an email from a listener named Owen who says, I have nothing against sharpening my aging brain, but I also think there ought to be some kind of game to teach younger generations to single task. The loss of focus caused by the distraction of multitasking is creating a culture that is a mile wide and an inch deep. All right, we'll get some more of your thoughts. We welcome you joining the conversation. Our toll-free number is available, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786. Your thoughts, your questions, your comments are welcome. Again, toll-free. Join us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you might have immediately on to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We'll continue with our guest again, Adam Ghazali, who's also co-founder of the company Achille Interactive Labs, developing the next generation of the NeuroRacer game, and that's what we're talking about. It's in the newest edition, September 5th edition of Nature magazine, called Game Changer. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, can video games make old brains act younger? We're talking with one of the leading researchers from a study that was published in the September 5th edition of Nature magazine. In fact, it's called Game Changer. And older adults demonstrated better multitasking skills and other cognitive functions after playing a custom-designed video game. That's according to this UCSF study. After months of playing the driving game called NeuroRacer, seniors were better at remembering information and at paying attention. And UCSF neuroscientist Adam Ghazali is with us in studio. He's one of the report's co-authors. We're talking to him about the potential use of video games as therapeutic tools to improve cognitive skills and to treat, well, problems, dementia, depression, ADHD, the whole possibility there without hyping it too much seems to open up. And you can actually see what this video game looks like by going to our website. A sample of what the video game looks like is there. You can check it out. Website is kqed.org/forum. And, of course, you can join this discussion. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, talking a little bit with Dr. Ghazali off air about, well, you're not necessarily an advocate of multitasking, apropos of that last email that I read before we went to the break that said maybe especially young people need to single task more or focus more. This is pretty nuanced what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think the subtleties and the nuances is why I'm here, right, to talk about that. I think the article describes all the data, but it is a much more complicated issue when you think about the real world. And one thing that I don't want to be a takeaway is that I'm encouraging people to multitask.
Spread yourself way too thin.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, I sort of give the other message. I did a show for PBS last year called The Distracted Mind. I'm working on a book on that topic now. And I think that in many ways, by dividing our attention and fragmenting it, we decrease our abilities and our performance across many different domains. I don't think our brains have evolved in a way to deal with that type of extreme multitasking. And so how we interact in the world in an effective way really frequently demands sustained attention and focus. And I do think that there's reason, at least for concern with younger adults growing up with our modern media, to develop those skills to sustain their attention. This project was not to encourage people to multitask. It was directly to address a deficit in older adults to be able to interact with their environment based on their goals, something we call cognitive control. And so by playing a game that had a high interference load, both in terms of distraction and multitasking, we felt we could put pressure on the neural processes that underlie sustained attention, working memory, other forms of control processes, and that's what I feel we were successful in doing. So I guess the message would be it is best to focus on things that are important to you, especially things that have a timestamp attached to them or that demand high quality. But in the real world, sometimes we do have to multitask and switch between multiple streams. And so when you're going to do that, you might as well be as good as you can be.
Well, we've got a question right away about multitasking, and that's from Eve in Alameda. Good morning, Eve.
Hi. Thank you very much for this program. I've always enjoyed it. I do have a question about my career as a nurse. I've been a nurse for over 30 years, and as my career has progressed, in particular in critical care, I feel like I've gotten very good at multitasking. I'm 54. And I just feel like because of what is expected in my job, I'm able to do it. And I wonder if there have been any studies that show anything like that.
Well, I haven't seen a study that showed exactly that. There have been studies that show that people that think they're very good at multitasking often are not when you take them into the lab and study it very carefully. I'm not saying that you're not, but that study has been done, especially in young adults. As a matter of fact, the exact opposite relationship has been shown in that children or young adults that feel that media multitask a lot. This is specifically about media multitasking, not necessarily what you describe related to work, that they tend to have poorer cognitive control abilities when you test them in the lab. It's not saying that there's a causal relationship, that by engaging in media in that way that it weakens cognitive control skills because it's a correlational study, but it could mean that having weaker cognitive control skills leads you to multitask more. But it is very complicated, and it could be different between young adults and older people and people throughout the lifespan. So it's
something
we need
more work. As you do things throughout the lifespan, though, it would seem that people do things almost by a kind of habitual remote control or something along those lines. In other words, they're not necessarily giving the kind of concentration to it because it's second nature to them. And as a result, there's possibly more interference.
Yeah, there's frequently more interference, and that's a term that we use to describe this very phenomena of having multiple streams of information going at the same time. I think that in many ways it's hard to know its impact on your performance. Now, sometimes it might not. If the tasks are not demanding of that really high level of quality and they're really boring, multitasking might be the appropriate thing to do. But then there are other times, like when you're driving and you shouldn't be texting, or while, you know, while you're doing something that really does deserve singular focus, that's not the time. So instead of thinking about it as good or bad, what we should do is use information about how it impacts us to make better decisions.
And we go to another call, and that's Duff. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. As a non-video gamer, I've always sort of hoped that some of my real life experiences had similar effects. And I recently read a study from Japan that I'm wondering if your guest has heard of, where they took a group of sort of older mid-level businessmen who had ridden motorcycles as young men but were no longer riding, got them commuting again to work on motorbikes, and found very similar results.
Yeah, there are a lot of studies that show sort of what we call expert studies. For example, it exists in the field of music research. People that have learned to play musical instruments when they were younger show differences in how their brain functions when they're older in life. And so, sure, I mean, there are definitely things that you could do in your everyday life that can impact your brain in a healthy way. What we've done here is just, it would be the equivalent in many ways of going to the gym and having a personal trainer. If you had a weakness, you might need a little extra focus on something that needed to be boosted. And that's where these adaptive algorithms that are part of our games come in. So in the real world, frequently, when you get better at something, it gets easier to you. So let's take the example of driving to work. You know, you're on this tough route. I drive down 16th Street, which is just a nightmare, trying to get to my lab. And I probably have gotten better at it over time. I understand how it works with the left lane not having a turning signal, and I should be in my right lane. And so it's gotten better. But as it's gotten easier, I haven't said, okay, I feel like I've mastered that. I should now find a harder route to work to challenge myself. That's not how it works. Very frequently in the real world, we tend to try to find the easier way and the more comfortable way of interacting. And the game does exact opposite. It never, ever lets go and just keeps pushing, just like a trainer would push. And so that's the advantage of this type of really targeted training. Not to say that you can't do it in the real world, just frequently people don't.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. You were talking, though, about texting while driving, and obviously that's not healthy, not good for your health. I have this notion somehow that, particularly seeing young people so often looking down at their iPhones or at their iPads or whatever it is they're looking down at and virtually engaged in, that it may actually be changing the neural pathways of the brain. And I think there's some evidence that shows that. I don't know that that's necessarily good. It would seem, in fact, maybe a little bit foreboding.
Well, I mean, we're always, in essence, changing the neural pathways in our brain. It's the essence of how our brain functions. We rewire it through all our interactions. Now, a strong impact on that standard pathway of how people have developed for a long period of time by a change in technology almost certainly is changing the brain of young people. But in itself, that's not necessarily a good or a bad thing. That's just how the brain works. We need more research to understand, though, how the new change in interactions, even with each other, even children interacting with each other because of changes in media, how that's going to impact them over the longer term. There's just really not a ton of research in that domain yet.
I wish I could be more optimistic, but you know, the thought of just looking at a device and being interactive with that device habitually and constantly as opposed to reality, nature, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand the concern. I think that a lot of people have it, and trying to dissect out what is happening and what its implications are is just a really important area of research right now. I agree with you.
Listener writes or asks, could you comment on the efficacy of Luminosity.com? That's a company that offers online brain games. Is this actually beneficial for healthy young or middle-aged people?
So in general, I'm not giving any particular endorsements for products right now at this stage. And largely that's because I feel that we are still at our infancy in understanding how to change the brain using video games. There's a lot of reason for excitement. I do feel that.
Don't you have a patent pending, though?
I think. Yep. So I have actually more than one now and a couple in development. So I am trying to develop technology that uses video game mechanics to do exactly these things. But I'm not endorsing my own products right now either. I feel like we do need a lot more work to understand. I think one of the confusions is that there's a difference between having things based on science and having things validated by science, right? So basing things on science is not that hard, right? I mean, yes, the brain is plastic and things we do for our brain do have the potential to tap into this plasticity and improve these abilities. But what has to happen is really careful studies of validation to compare against controls that are appropriate, and then to look at what the impacts are and what they're not, and to understand if the side effect profiles. All of this has to occur for us to be confident in what will have an impact that's worth investing in.
Well, Ramin says, do strategy games such as Civilization computer game or even chess have any observable effects on the brain? Have these sorts of games been studied? What differences would you expect from the action sort of games?
Yep, there is some data on that, not a lot. And again, of you know, these games have been shown to have some effects. There's a little bit of a difference in general between strategy approaches and what we're talking about with our game, which is more of a process-based approach, not good or bad. In general, people found that strategy approaches lead to really big impacts, but less transfer to other domains. While the process approach, which is what we've done here, where you just keep practicing something again and again and just keep pushing those skills, maybe more similar to like a fitness in the gym, might not have as large an impact, but might have more transfer to different domains. A lot of that still remains to be seen. But, you know, in general, I think that games are a powerful way of capturing our attention and changing our behavior. And they'll have all different types of impacts, just like drugs have different type of impacts. And that's what we have to understand is how do we harness these different games to lead to targeted improvements in different abilities and in different populations.
And have impacts, I think you're intimating, at least potentially diagnostically, therapeutically.
That is really my hope. Achilles come up a couple times, and it's a company that I help co-found and serve as an advisor for, and they don't have a product yet either, which is the frustrating news because they still have to do a lot of studies with what is the next version of NeuroRacer. So NeuroRacer is not a product, and there's no intentions of it becoming one. It just wasn't designed that way. But this company is developing a game that's based on the technology underlying NeuroRacer, but this study will not validate it for uses by that group. They have to go and have other researchers do a whole new set of studies and see if it can be used as a diagnostic and therapeutic. Interestingly enough, the company is not directing itself at consumer games like Lumosity and other groups have done where they're just available, but trying to go through a careful clinical validation process across different sites to see, does this really have impact in different populations, and can it even reach the level of FDA approval, and where it is a diagnostic and a therapeutic, no different than a drug is right now. And that really hasn't happened yet, but I think that holds great promise.
Again, our guest is Adam Ghazali. He directs the Neuroscience Imaging Center at the University of California, San Francisco, and is co-founder of Achille Interactive Labs. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll bring a caller, Richard, on. Good morning.
This is Richard from Mountain View.
Hi, Richard.
Hi, I'm a caregiver for my wife. We're both 87. She's got maybe it's Alzheimer's. You never know. And I have her on a ketone diet, which has really improved. I just think it's stabilized things. But I'm wondering if you have anything particular that would suggest any help, at the stage that you're in, what you can recommend.
Yeah. I sympathize with your situation. I'm a neurologist in addition to being a neuroscientist. Certainly when it comes to Alzheimer's disease, I've had a lot of experience. And, right now our general recommendations are engaging as much as you can with things around you, trying to keep your brain healthy. Physical exercise is something that there's been a lot of excitement about. So those are the things that I recommend from a clinical point of view. But I am really encouraged by a lot of the work that is starting to appear that reveal to us, as I said, the ingredients in this recipe to keep our brain healthy. But physical exercise is one that I strongly endorse.
And thank you for the call. Good luck to you, Richard. Appreciate your calling. Carol from Walnut Creek writes, last evening I watched a POV documentary on one of KQED channels about senior competitive ping pong players. And at the World Championship senior ping pong tournament held in China in 2010, one of the participants was an 89-year-old German woman. This woman had gone to the nursing home with dementia and had been coached in the game of ping pong there. And at first, she could barely hold the bat. And in the dialogue, she states that after learning and practicing the game, her dementia disappeared. Bernice writes, how does one participate in these type of studies? And you get a lot of those questions, people who want to be part of it, I'm sure. But she also says, consider a game that has other settings than driving, such as shopping.
Yeah, we have lots of new games in the lab that are in incubation stage. They're not associated with any company. They're just things that we're developing out. And hopefully someday they'll leave the lab and someone will develop them as products. One of them that I think people would find interesting is that we're building a game. This is an NIH-funded study to take the principles behind concentrative meditation and integrate it with video game dynamics that we've been using in our studies right now. It's actually an iPad game.
Did NIH fund the NeuroRacer study too? A lot of people are asking about funding.
The main funding for that study came from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. It was actually very hard to get studies 5 years ago to work on video games. If you put video game in a title of an NIH grant, it didn't seem to be a very effective route.
You got this whole Blue Skies thing going on at UCSF. Right?
Yeah, things are changing now. We do have funding for this meditation-inspired video game that's going on in the Bay Area now. And we have four other games, one focused on attention, one focused on long-term memory, one is focused on rhythm. And all of them are coupled with brain recordings to understand how they work and what are their limitations.
Here's Francis. Francis, join us. Hi.
Oh, thank you. I have just a couple of questions. I'll give a little background. I'm almost 90, and I'm in the middle of writing a book involving symbolic logic, et cetera, not exactly a cup of tea. And my mother finished, only due to blindness, working on a biography of her father at 94, which got published. I'm not clear as to the issue of speed versus understanding or wisdom, you might say, and also the notion of the difference between understanding concepts and simply handling daily life. In other words, I'm dealing with abstract concepts and so forth and so on. And as I said, my mother was writing. All of this involves words. It doesn't require the speed, and these games and things all seem to be how fast you can do this kind of stuff. I was in a research project as a guinea pig a couple of years ago at UC, and I aced all these things where the dots jumped all over the place and so forth and so on. But on the memory list, which was totally boring, 20 words, cat, dog, blah, 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 I could only remember three words, and I think it was due to lack of interest rather than failed brains. So
yeah, but you're asking about speed and pace.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, so cognition is incredibly complicated, and part of the problem of just delivering a message is that the details get lost. And we know that as we age, first of all, there's lots of individual variability, and some older adults really do remarkably well when you compare them to 20-year-olds. But in general, we see that what I described before as fluid cognitive abilities, things like processing speed, working memory, task switching, resistance to distraction, multitasking, these type of skills decline. Other skills like vocabulary, just semantic knowledge about the world, world, as well as wisdom might maintain or even improve. So it's not that everything changes in the same way. And depending on what is valuable to your life, it might not matter as much if this real rapid speed of processing declines, or it might matter a lot if you're trying to hold your job and work alongside 20-year-olds and keep doing what you love to do, and that's being right in the thick of it all. So it's very personal in a lot of ways about what is most valuable to you in your cognition, and we're trying to tease apart all the different cognitive abilities and how we can keep people on top of the game, whatever that might mean to them.
Well, Francis, good luck in completing your book, and it sounds like you got a good gene pool there with a 94-year-old mother having done a book as well. Thank you for the call. Allison writes, some scientists say estrogen and testosterone enhance memory and brain function. In your study, did you include people who were on hormone replacement therapy, bioidentical or synthetic? And what's your view on estrogen supplementation for aging women? Is it also possible that estrogen may also increase the risk of dementia?
Yeah, it's a really complicated topic. It's not my primary realm of research, so I don't want to dive in too deep. But there has been a lot of work. I actually did some of it 20 years ago showing that estrogen can have an impact on the neural systems involved in memory. But of course, it's not without other potential risks. So it is more complicated. In our study, we didn't disqualify people for that type of use of hormone replacement therapy. It is something that we would love to tease apart in a larger study where you can see all the subtle impacts of those type of treatments.
I remind you, you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Adam Ghazali, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny, and we will go to another call here in just a moment. Just want to remind you, this is a fundraising period. Let me go to a caller, Stephen. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Here's another point of view from a letter that was published in The New Yorker this week from David Hambrick, who's a professor of Department of Psychology at Michigan State University, and I'd like Dr. Ghazali to comment on it. He writes, Patricia Marks tests the benefits of brain training and mentions the studies that both support and dispute such exercises and how they work. In a key study published in Developmental Psychology, researchers identified 23 studies of brain training programs. They concluded that there was no convincing evidence that brain training improves intelligence or academic skills. As Marks writes, brain training makes people better at the training task, but not much else. When benefits are demonstrated, interpretation of the results is complicated by flawed research designs and by research financial interests in the brain training products. Making people's lives better through brief economical brain training is an appealing idea, but one for which there is currently no solid scientific support. I'd appreciate a comment by Dr. Ghazali on this letter.
Yeah, so there are a lot of studies out there that have not done a great job of controlling the populations and also looking for this really elusive phenomena transfer. I think that our study, you know, at least to some degree, addresses both of those. We had two control groups, one of which was an active control group that played a version of the game, which was our main training focus, that only differed in one component, and that's the single task versus the multitask. So I think that we had a really nice control group there. And we also show that in addition to the skills on the game that that have improved, other cognitive skills that were not directly targeted by the game, such as working memory and sustained attention, which is vigilance, also improved. So, you know, I think that this is the very early stages of a field. Hopefully, we have one step in the right direction to showing that we can have some nice impact with a targeted game to a population with a reasonable control group. And hopefully, there'll be more that follow that.
And Stephen, we thank you for your call, and we'll go right to another caller. Kurt, you're on. Kurt, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two teenage boys, and I watch them play video games. And I wonder if there's any research that shows that playing video games sort of overstimulates them or has a dopamine effect. Is there some sort of pleasure center that's activated? And does that sort of lead them to seek out other stimulating things?
Yeah, there have been research that show that you know, there's a dopamine relationship with video game playing. It shouldn't be so surprising, you know, that neurotransmitter is related to our reward system. There's no doubt that video games are designed with reward in mind, and that's why people love them and play them.
That's why people keep going over and over again to check their email, too, or their Facebook page.
Exactly. And, you know, there are many, many aspects of how we interact with our world that might drive the reward system. So I think that that part of it is both a good because it can have people engage in something that might help them, but also a danger that has to be taken into consideration. We wouldn't want these games to become all-consuming.
And we thank you, Kurt, for your call. And here's a listener, Paul, who writes, is the guest familiar with NBAC? NBAC is a continuous performance task used to assess cognitive neuroscience. And if public funds are involved, would the game be made public?
Yeah, the NBAC is a working memory test that is used to assess one aspect of cognitive control. And I know that that has been developed to some degree. I'm not sure. I know that there's some research that that is available through a group to help train working memory abilities. As far as our own game, we are now trying to figure out the best way to move it out of the laboratory into a format that can impact people's lives in a positive way. This transition from lab to real world is not always so easy.
And Chris writes, for those of us, well, we've kind of answered this in a way, keep your brain active and all that, but I wonder what other wisdom you can shed on this question. For those of us who are older and don't have time to wait, please tell us what the best things are we can do for our brains now.
Well, I'd say physical fitness has really yielded a remarkable amount of evidence that it has a powerful effect on keeping our brains healthy. So getting out and walking, interacting with other people, and pushing your brains, challenging yourself in your daily lives, I think are really a strong approach to keeping your brain healthy.
Keeping it stimulated too, right?
Stimulation.
Yeah, I mean, that's
sure.
Another way of saying that.
For sure.
Well, again, congratulations on the research that you've done. I think it is quite important. And again, listeners can see a sample of what the video game looks like. Check it out on our website, kqed.org/forum, where you can also continue this discussion. Good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.
Adam Ghazali, again, is director of Neuroscience Imaging Center at UCSF and co-founder of the company Achille Interactive Labs, which is developing the next generation of the NeuroRacer game. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to extend thanks to senior editor Dan Zoll and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with assistance from David Marks. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.